This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
In the theme of reading poetry, I wanted to start tonight with a poem, Back to Mary Oliver, one of my favorites, The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? As we've been every week, we are very privileged today to have a wonderful speaker with us, Dr. Christine Ritchie. Christine is a dear friend and colleague. Christine is a professor of medicine here at UCSF. She is the Harris Fishbon Distinguished Professor at UCSF. She is a geriatrician, an internist, and a palliative care physician. Christine is a world-renowned researcher in palliative care and a great mentor and a great teacher as well. And she is also this year the president of our professional society, the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. And we are in for a treat tonight as Christine Ritchie speaks to us on easing the pain, approaches to managing pain associated with serious illness. Please join me in welcoming Christine Ritchie.
So good evening. I really am so grateful that you're here. So anyway, thank you for being here. And what I'd like to do tonight is just talk to you a little bit about pain management, especially in the context of illness and serious illness. And, you know, I think pain is one of these things that we all, in some respects, are experts about. I mean, all of us have experienced some kind of pain. You know, even if it was a stub toe, but generally it's much more than that. And pain includes broken hearts and disappointments and many other things in addition to physical pain. And that's what makes pain pretty complicated. So when we think about physical pain, generally what we think about is this whole thing where if you do stub your toe, that information is passed from the skin or from that pressure point here into a very complex system of nerves that go up your spinal cord into your brain and then back down from your brain to respond with this look. And that is essentially what happens with acute pain in particular, where there's some definite insult or injury that occurs, and then from in response to that, we generally have some immediate sort of emotional or affective or verbal response. Chronic pain is actually a lot more complex. It also encompasses an unpleasant sensation. But it often encompasses an unpleasant sensation for a long period of time. And in fact, in sort of the medical literature, for something to be considered chronic pain, someone has had to have experienced it for at least 3 months or more. And actually, it may no longer be associated with the thing that initiated the pain. So the pain that actually the injury or insult that occurred that sort of led to the beginning of the pain may no longer be present, and yet that pain is still experienced. And for many, that pain, kind of pain is profoundly difficult to manage on a day-to-day basis. And with serious illness, we see actually all different kinds of pain. We see pain that is acute because of the nature. Thank you so much. The nature of the illness that the person is experiencing, and then we also see pain that is much more chronic and that also has a lot of difficulty and sometimes profound fatigue associated with it. So how common is pain? Actually, it's quite common, and in our society, the United States, pain is present in community-dwelling adults at least 30 to 50% of the time, and depending on, again, how it's defined, even more. In nursing homes, generally where people have more serious illness and more chronic conditions, the prevalence is higher. And then in palliative care patients, which is a patient population that we spend a lot of time providing care to, the prevalence is even higher, really in the 70 to 90% range. And in one study that came out fairly recently, that pain wasn't just mild pain. A quarter of those individuals had severe or overwhelming pain. And that's really what none of us would want. And a lot of what we'll talk about tonight is how to manage that kind of pain. So I had the pleasure of speaking to some colleagues at Massachusetts General about a year and a half ago, and I spoke in the Ether Dome. And this actually quote is from the Ether Dome, and it is commemorating the anniversary of when ether was publicly given in a surgical suite. Back then, the surgical suites had a number of people looking just like in this auditorium down at the surgery as it was being performed. And it was the first time that ether actually was being used publicly. And I just want to read to you what it says. "Whatever triumphs still hold the mind, whatever gifts shall yet enrich mankind, ah, here no hour shall strike through all the years, no hour as sweet as when hope, doubt, and fears, mid deepening stillness, watched one eager brain with godlike will decree the death of pain." Now, that was also present. We have conquered pain. And certainly, there is a way to conquer pain, but that requires complete anesthesia and sedation, and most of us don't want to spend our life like that. So we actually have not conquered pain, but we are developing increasing strategies for both understanding pain and finding ways to support people as they walk through pain so that they can manage it more effectively. As we talked about at the beginning, pain is a complex phenomenon that is not just physical in nature, and that's what makes it particularly challenging to provide support to and manage, both for the person who's experiencing it and for the people who are trying to support and manage that pain. There's the biological feature that may be related to the disease, like osteoarthritis, for example. There are the biologic mechanisms of psychiatric illnesses, like depression, that often augment the experience of pain. There's the psychological factors that relate to distress associated to what that pain is causing in someone's life. I'm not able to do what I used to do. I'm not able to care for the people I want to care for. Anger, fear, what does this mean for the future? What does it mean that I'm actually having more pain? And then traumatic life events often can contribute and augment the pain experience for people who've had those kind of traumatic experiences in their past. Social stressors, of course, can also influence the pain experience. So environmental stressors, whether or not someone actually has a roof over their head, whether or not they're getting along with the persons who are in their home, if they do have a roof over their head, all those things contribute to the experience of pain and, again, contribute to its complexity. Another way to think about it is to think about all these various factors that contribute to pain, both from the genetic perspective, which all these, you know, how long your telomere is, how active it is, whether or not, how much you've experienced DNA methylation because of actually other environmental stressors, these psychological and cognitive factors, your health status, your sex, pain transmission, and then all these things on the outside. We know from the scientific literature all these factors influence the experience of pain, again, contributing to its complexity and in terms of its management. So how might we think about managing pain? There's, again, this sort of holistic perspective that has to come into play when one is thinking about pain. First, there's the biological piece, and we're going to spend some time, a good bit of time, talking about medications for pain. Exercise, surgery, we will not be talking about surgery tonight, but there are surgical manipulations that can occur to manage some kinds of pain. Sleep is a big factor with pain and people's pain experience, whether or not they can access health care, their family situation, their work situation. And then we'll spend some time talking about cognitions, emotions, behaviors, and attention, because these actually end up being quite powerful in terms of how easy or difficult it is for someone to manage their pain. So we'll first talk about pharmacotherapy, and then we'll talk about some of these non-pharmacologic approaches. So in terms of pharmacotherapy, for actually many years, we have followed something from that was actually first developed by the World Health Organization called the three-step ladder. And the World Health Organization tried to sort of think about or describe pain in, from the standpoint of sort of mild, moderate, and severe, and made recommendations for medications based on that. And actually, to this day, a lot of the way healthcare providers manage pain is influenced by this ladder. So for mild pain, starting with something like aspirin, Tylenol or acetaminophen, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, plus minus adjuvants, most of the adjuvants are actually medicines that were used for other things that we now have learned to be important in pain, things like gabapentin, which was first used for things like seizures, and things like duloxetine, which was used for depression. Then second, for the moderate level, is where we actually fall into a number of opioids that are prescribed for pain: tramadol, oxycodone, hydrocodone, and codeine. Again, the use of adjuvants is recommended across the continuum of pain. And then finally, for most severe pain, medicines like morphine, methadone, fentanyl, and again, you see some overlap between moderate and severe pain. Now, we have learned some things recently, which I will describe, will go over with you, that makes us take this stepladder a little bit with a grain of salt. And in particular, we've learned things about non-steroidals and about opioids that enable, that actually require us to think about benefits and burdens for those two medications in particular every time we prescribe them. And we'll talk about those benefits and burdens. So Tylenol. Tylenol is actually the safest medication for pain on the market, and it's still not altogether safe. All of you, I'm sure, have heard of people who have died from essentially liver failure from Tylenol overdoses. It is not a completely safe medication. It just happens to be more safe than most of our other choices. It's a medicine that can be taken around the clock, or it can be taken as needed. It is generally recommended that a healthy person not take more than 4,000 milligrams within a 24-hour period. As one ages, because of changes that occur in terms of the way the liver processes Tylenol, we generally don't recommend that people who are in their 70s and 80s really take more than 3,000 milligrams over a 24-hour period. It's very important to read labels, because a lot of times Tylenol is lurking around in other medications that you don't know about, that and it's in there. And so if one is actually taking Tylenol and then develops a cold and takes some cold medicine, more often than not, that cold medicine also has Tylenol in it, often 500 milligrams. If you take three of the cold medicines, three to six of your regular Tylenol, you've gone way over the limit of that 3,000 or 4,000 milligrams. So it's very important to pay attention to that. But it is actually recommended as first-line therapy for pain. Now, back in the day, we used to think nonsteroidals were pretty safe, and we recommended them to pretty much everybody and thought of them as sort of a good next step for pain management. Unfortunately, in the recent years, we've learned that nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory agents, and these include a whole plethora of medicines that you can get over the counter, including ibuprofen, naproxen, ketoprofen, and others, actually have significant safety issues. Many, many hospitalizations occur each year because of the side effects of nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory agents, and up to 16,000 deaths each year because of this medicine. And the reason is because this medicine can actually, if someone has underlying heart failure, make it worse, so much worse that it can lead to hospitalization. It can make your blood pressure worse. It can actually make your kidney function significantly worse. And more recently, we've realized that it significantly increases the risk for stroke and heart attack. In addition to all those things, it also increases risk for GI bleeding. So a lot of risks associated with things that actually you can get easily, pick up at the drugstore tonight, that we don't think about, but that actually are quite important to be aware of as you're considering these medications. Many people who are on blood pressure medicines will go ahead, you know, they will have some situation, maybe they threw out their back, they'll start taking ibuprofen thinking, well, there's no harm in that, and suddenly their blood pressure is out of control. And what they don't realize is it's that ibuprofen that is contributing to their blood pressure being more difficult to manage. Now, opioids are actually what a lot of people call narcotics. In palliative care, we try to avoid the use of the term narcotics because narcotics is actually a legal term to describe all controlled medications, including medicines that are not opioids, medicines that are often put in the, considered tranquilizers or sedatives, and they are not opioids at all. So to be actually more accurate, we use the word opioids as opposed to narcotics. Also, narcotics tends to have a little bit of a negative sort of vibe to it, a stigma associated with it. So we prefer to use the word opioids. But it encompasses all those medicines you saw in the World Health Organization ladder, like morphine, oxycodone, hydrocodone, and fentanyl patch. Now, opioids have actually been demonstrated to be very effective in the treatment of cancer-related pain, many types of acute pain, and some types of chronic pain. However, they have lots of side effects, and many of those side effects preclude people from being able to use them effectively. The one that does not go away, that actually has to be managed alongside the use of opioids, is constipation. Now, there have been a very small subset of folks that I've had the privilege of caring for who've had problems with their bowels to the extent that they were delighted to be on a medicine that made them constipated, but that would be the exception, not the rule. Most people find that quite distressing, and generally speaking, people require some kind of medicine to address constipation if they're on these medicines. Now, sleepiness, nausea, and itching tend to be actually side effects that go away over time. Sleepiness in particular, after 2 to 3 days of being on most opioid medications, will dissipate, and people will generally feel more like themselves after those first few days. There are exceptions to that rule, and we'll talk about that as well. Itching is most common in morphine, and a lot of times people experience itching with one class of opioid medication that they won't experience with another. So if one experiences itching, especially with morphine, it's because morphine contributes to the release of histamine from mast cells, which are a certain kind of cell in our body that's associated with allergies, and that contributes to the itching. And for some people, that becomes a reason they actually cannot take morphine. As I mentioned, opioids are generally effective at treating pain. They tend to be particularly underused by older adults because of all the concerns associated with the use of these medicines, some very legitimate concerns, but oftentimes many people who would benefit from these medications end up being afraid to take them and then actually experience less quality of lives and decreased function as a result. There are many barriers to use, and if any of you have been following the legislation that's been happening nationally and in the state of California, you'll know that there are increasing restrictions on the use of opioids. Now, most opioids require a paper prescription, so they cannot be called in. This means that if someone experiences intense or acute pain in the middle of the night, and one doesn't have pain medicines available to them, oftentimes it means a trip to the emergency room because there's no easy way to actually access that medicine otherwise. Physicians find all the new regulations around opioids also difficult, and so most physicians are also less inclined to prescribe these medications because of the increasing numbers of barriers associated with their use. When one thinks about any medication, but particularly opioid medications, one has to actually use this kind of scale to weigh the pros and the cons. And I'd like to just go through them one by one. So analgesia is another term for just pain relief. And we do know that opioids in particular are pretty effective at improving pain and improving function and improving quality of life. The adverse effects are quite variable, and so they have to be addressed on a case-by-case basis. The harm that can occur is harms around overdose, misuse, not just by the person who is prescribed the medicine, but by other people in that person's life who uses them even though they weren't prescribed. Concerns around addiction, drug-drug and drug-disease interactions, and then physical dependence and tolerance, which, although it's listed here, actually occurs much less commonly than we originally thought. And what that means is that for some individuals, because of the metabolism of their body, the same amount of medicine over time is not as effective. That actually occurs fairly infrequently. And when people have increasing levels of pain after they've been on a regular dose of an opioid medicine for a long period of time, that's really reason for an additional evaluation to make sure something else isn't contributing to that pain. So let's talk now about the sort of issues around opioid medication and nonsteroidals. We've talked about Tylenol, so we know Tylenol is out there as an option for folks. But for many people, it's going to require more than Tylenol, especially if they have a serious illness for their pain. So how do we actually evaluate the pros and cons of these two key pillars of pain management? Well, it's worth looking at sort of what's called the effect size. So a small effect size would be considered under 0.5 in this table, and a large effect size would be greater than 0.8, 0.5 to 0.79, somewhere in between. What we know with oral nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory agents and topical, this is like topical Voltaren, or Voltaren gel that you can get, is that these medicines are less effective for pain reduction than opioids. They are also less likely to improve physical functioning than opioids, but all of these medicines have some benefit. We don't actually have very good data on the impact of these medicines on sleep. We do know that opioids do improve overall sleep quality. And in terms of quality of life and socialization, the research is all over the map in terms of whether or not they have an overall positive impact of quality of life and socialization or negative. And I think it's because we've tried to actually put everything, mush everything together, not take into account the individual characteristics of the person receiving the medicine or the individual characteristics of each particular medicine. And for that reason, there's a lot of actual lack of clarity about those two outcomes. Now, what about the risks? So we talked about this already, but what a lot of people don't realize is that there are a lot of risks associated with the use of nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory agents. Acute kidney injury, chronic kidney disease progression, if someone already has some underlying kidney dysfunction, risk for stroke, risk for heart attack, risk for congestive heart failure, and risk for blood pressure. We don't see those kind of risks for topical nonsteroidals, and we do see some increased risks in large epidemiologic studies for heart attack and congestive heart failure, but honestly, we don't know what the mechanism of action is for that in opioid use specifically, and very little data of opioids in any population that has serious illness and multiple chronic conditions. Now, where we actually do see meaningful risk for opioids is in the realm of falls. And not surprisingly, we talked about how opioids do increase people's sleepiness and lethargy, especially when they first start on these medicines. There is a subset of individuals who do become more confused on these medicines. Your blood pressure can sometimes drop on these medicines. All those things add up to an increased risk for falls and secondarily to an increased risk for fracture. What we don't see with opioids are the risks for GI ulceration and bleed, which is a significant issue, especially in non-selective, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, but still an issue with selective anti-inflammatory agents. And in all of these instances, we see an increased risk for hospitalization. So to sum up then, we do have some treatments for pain, and these treatments actually have some meaningful effectiveness associated with them, but they also have meaningful burden and adverse effects associated with them, and it's that burden that we have to constantly weigh when we're trying to make decisions about these different pain medications. For non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, as we mentioned, it's that GI bleeding and the kidney injury, possibly worsening of heart failure. For opioids, it's the falls and the fractures, the constipation, the mental status changes, especially at the beginning of therapy, and this concern and, around overdose. Now, I mentioned constipation earlier because it's such a common issue in opioids. I just want to sort of highlight it again as being something to attend to. It is the most common adverse effect. It's the reason many people discontinue taking opioids. And there's no tolerance that's developed for this particular side effect, so it actually has to be addressed in a proactive way. And we generally recommend that prophylactic laxatives be used. A lot of times, a laxative like Miralax or polyethylene glycol or Senna or Bisacodyl are all good choices that can be used and have a meaningful benefit when you're on these medicines. Stool softeners really aren't sufficient, so Docusate by itself is not a sufficient prophylactic approach towards managing constipation. Cathartics like Senna and Bisacodyl, osmotic laxatives, which basically pull in water and help sort of move the stools along, include magnesium, lactulose, and sorbitol. And in addition to that, the polyethylene glycol, which is not listed on this slide. Fiber is not a way to address constipation in someone who's on opioids. So these are two things that often I find folks do just when they go to the drugstore, they look and there's a stool softener there and that sounds about right. Or they see Metamucil and that's a fiber agent, so maybe that'll work. They actually are not helpful when someone is on chronic opioids, and we would discourage their routine use if someone's not also on one of these other kind of laxatives. Now, what about sedation and cognitive impairment? There are a few things that we often do when people are complaining of continued sedation and cognitive impairment. So, as I mentioned at the beginning, most people who have some sedation on the initiation of opioids have it for a short period of time, and then it goes away. But there is a subset of individuals who just, they continue to be sleepy all the time. It's disruptive. It's negatively influencing their quality of life. And even though they may appreciate the fact that their pain is reduced, they don't like being sleepy or what some people will call fuzzy-headed all the time. And so for those individuals, it's very important to look at all their medications and say, are there any other medications that could be contributing to this person's sleepiness or fuzzy-headedness that we could also potentially discontinue that's no longer needed? And try that first. If that doesn't work, then look for other potential causes of sleepiness and sedation, because many times it can be from a number of other things that are going on with the underlying illness. if the pain is well controlled, one can try by just backing off just a little bit on their pain medicine to see if they're still getting good pain control at a lower dose. If, on the other hand, that their pain is not optimally controlled, then there are other medicines that we sometimes use, especially for people with serious illness, that can help. Something like a psychostimulant, something like actually Ritalin, which is often used for attention deficit disorder, actually works very well as a way of sort of helping people be more energized on these medicines. To switch to an alternative opioid often is quite effective. And in addition to that, trying other approaches that don't require as much oral medication can be a way of decreasing this risk for sedation and cognitive impairment. When you do experience dose-limiting effects of the medicines, and generally what we see with opioid medications in particular, is though we can continue to go up on the dose, people's side effects become more and more problematic, and that often is the dose-limiting effect that keeps us from going up on the dose. Then we try some of these adjuvant agents, medicines like gabapentin, like venlafaxine, like duloxetine. Venlafaxine and duloxetine are medicines that are used for depression and for anxiety. And so oftentimes if someone is experiencing depression and anxiety at the same time, it can actually be a nice way of addressing more than one thing by including that as part of the regimen. Sometimes we can, depending on where the pain is being experienced, use intraspinal or intrathecal approaches to providing pain relief. That requires much lower dose of these medicines and has much fewer effects on the brain. And then there are other approaches that require sort of invasive anesthetic approaches where perhaps parts of nerves are actually ablated or eradicated as a way of decreasing the pain associated with that particular issue. We'll talk about physical medicine and rehabilitation approaches, cognitive therapy, and complementary therapies. These, in my estimation, should always be a part of a pain regimen, always. Now, many of you, in fact, I think it's probably hard not to hear about all the challenges associated with opioids these days because, unfortunately, there's been increasing amounts of misuse of opioids and increasing amount of misuse, not just on the part of patients, but also on the part of providers, not necessarily being quite attentive enough to these side effects and these issues that we have to be attentive to when we're on these medicines. So what you see here is that over the because of sort of this recognition that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents weren't as risk-free as we thought, you know, there weren't a lot of other choices. And so what you've seen, again, is both with an increasing number of individuals who are experiencing chronic serious illness and this increasing awareness of these other medicines having risks associated with them, this growth in the use of opioids. And now I think what we're seeing is, oops, maybe we're using them too much, or maybe we're not being attentive enough to some of the side effects and the safety issues around them. And as a result, there's a lot of attention now to try to be much more thoughtful and educated about the way opioids are used than they have been in the past. And here's the reason. If you look at drug overdose deaths of all incidents, intents by major subtype in the United States, what you see here is that, you know, heroin has gone up a little bit, cocaine went up and then came down, and now, unfortunately, opioids are becoming one of the most common drugs of misuse and of overdose. And that's a very alarming statistic and something we actually have to be attentive to. The challenge is not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. That is to make sure those individuals who really need this medicine can get it, but that we actually have safeguards in place so that individuals who would not benefit from this medicine or who are not using this medicine appropriately are not able to access it. The other thing that I think we've learned is that very few people at low doses of these medicines have troubles with them associated with overdose. It's really when you get into these much higher dosing ranges that you see problems with overdose and overdose risk. So part of what's happening now, both in the state of California and nationally, is a real push to make sure that healthcare providers actually are well-educated about that and are well-educated about how to best prescribe opioids. A lot more emphasis on making sure that physicians in particular are going through regular training, and happily in the state of California, it's required, but elsewhere it's being increasingly encouraged. Now, what about non-pharmacologic approaches to pain? There are a whole host of non-pharmacologic approaches that are actually also quite effective, especially the top two, rehab and behavioral approaches, and that really need to be a part of our sort of general strategy for supporting someone who has a serious illness and who has pain. So what about physical therapy? It's actually very important pretty much across the board, regardless of how serious someone's pain is. So back in the day, we used to think when people had serious illness or even when they went on hospice that physical therapy wouldn't be appropriate for them anymore because we weren't actually trying to make them, you know, walk again or walk better or that sort of thing. But what we've learned is actually physical therapy is helpful for people regardless of what their functional status is like. It can actually improve their pain, decrease their pain by a significant amount, and it's very much underused in the United States. Last year, there was legislation that came out from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services that have actually loosened the reduced the restrictions around the use of physical therapy in home health. That's a very positive thing because many people who would have benefited from physical therapy in home had not been able to access it because of some of these restrictions provided by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. There are both passive strategies that physical therapists use and active strategies. The passive strategies often relate to the use of heat and cold, the use of electrical neurostimulation units, which transcutaneous electrical neurostimulation units are TENS units, which actually in a way serve as a sort of a distraction device for pain and in some types of pain can be quite effective. Ultrasound that can be particularly useful for muscle pain, and then a lot of active physical therapy that's around stretching, strengthening, deep tissue massage, and pain relief. And these have been demonstrated to be effective almost regardless of where someone is in their illness experience and in the illness continuum. Now, cognitive behavioral therapy, how many of you are familiar with cognitive behavioral therapy in this room? Good. Okay. Well, for those of you who are not as familiar, cognitive behavioral therapy is one of the strategies and tools for pain that has been demonstrated time and time again to be effective in reducing pain and especially improving function for those individuals experiencing pain. And it's interesting because it actually requires a totally different sort of way of thinking about pain than many people who are experiencing pain. So it does require some training and some guidance for many people as they're first trying to get used to using cognitive behavioral therapy. For most of us, when we experience pain, it's not just the pain sensation itself that's causing us distress. It's our interpretation of the pain. What does this mean? What am I going to do? How am I going to cope? How am I going to manage? And we go down very quickly a path of increasing distress and negative feelings about and cognitions, messages to ourselves about the pain. And what cognitive behavioral therapy tries to do is first help people see that they're doing that, that they're basically their recordings to themselves are the recordings that are actually contributing to their pain, and help them think of more adaptive and constructive messages to give themselves when they're experiencing pain. And this is work. As I say to folks when we're talking to them about this kind of therapy, this is not passive work. This is actually active work to do cognitive behavioral therapy. But what we do find is that people are willing to go there and actually use cognitive behavioral therapy is one of their strategies for managing pain. They have been demonstrated to have increased functional capacity, increased coping, and as a general matter, improved quality of life. Now, two other related behavioral therapies that are similar but not the same, and in fact, mindfulness, you could say, is almost sort of, in some respects, a a completely different domain than cognitive behavioral therapy is relaxation training and mindfulness therapy. So back to cognitive behavioral therapy, what people often do is they catastrophize about their pain. This is going to just, you know, change my life forever. I'll never be able to do X again. I'm never going to be able to, go to, see my grandchildren again. Whatever it is, the catastrophizing actually augments the pain. And so identifying those thoughts, actually accepting the pain condition, and then changing those thoughts to actually more adaptive thoughts influences emotions and actually allows one to then engage in activities that otherwise one often chooses to avoid out of fear, not out of actual need to avoid those activities. So as you can imagine, if you're experiencing pain, this is hard work to engage in this kind of activity. People have to want to engage in cognitive behavioral therapy, but it is a very, very effective strategy for addressing pain. Now, relaxation training, most of us have heard about, because now actually even when you go on long plane flights, they'll often have little movies of here's what you need to do to relax on the plane, especially if you're on an overnighter to Europe or Asia. So this has now become more mainstreamed, but relaxation therapy has also been demonstrated to be beneficial for pain, and there are strategies associated with it. So deep breathing is where one actually, in a very systematic and rhythmic way, takes in a breath and then slowly releases it, takes in a breath through one's nose, slowly releases it out of one's mouth, and does that in a systematic and rhythmic way between 5 and 10 times, depending on how easy or hard that is for one to do. Guided imagery is where one actually visualizes or goes through a visualization, either with coaching by someone who's sort of guiding you through it or through your own work, of positive or relaxing scenarios that actually contribute to relaxation. And then progressive muscle relaxation is where you, and there are many different ways to do this, is where you actually think about each muscle in your body, again, in a systematic way, many times starting with your toes and going up to your head and systematically relaxing each of those muscles as you're moving up your body. There are many tools online. There are also a number of apps. One app that I'd love for you to try out is a relatively new app. It's called Pacifica. It was actually developed by some of our colleagues here. It has actually some combination of both deep breathing, and it does not have guided imagery or progressive muscle relaxation, but it also has cognitive behavioral therapy as part of its tools to support people who are experiencing both pain, anxiety, and depression. Now, mindfulness is actually a slightly different strategy than traditional cognitive behavioral therapy, even though they're related, because it actually it focuses on awareness. And so rather than actually sort of escaping from your pain by visualizing something else or engaging in other thoughts and activities, it's actually being fully present to and aware of one's pain. And what actually happens is, if you are fully present and aware of your pain, again, not engaging in all the negative interpretations of the pain, but just the full awareness and experience of the pain, what people have come to realize is that the pain actually has less power over people when they do that. John Kabat-Zinn has done a lot of work. He's at the University of Massachusetts. He's done a lot of work. This is a really great book if you're interested in this sort of thing, The Mindfulness Solution to Pain. There are a number of strategies, again, that you can find online that can guide you through a mindfulness approach towards pain. But it is a very interesting strategy that's about being fully present to your current situation, accepting of it, not going down, again, a lot of negative cognitions, which tend to amplify the pain. And by being fully present to it, many people who have pain will say that their pain doesn't feel as powerful and it doesn't feel as intense or severe. Some other mindfulness-based stress reductions is something called the body scan. And this is different than what I just talked about in terms of muscle relaxation. So in muscle relaxation, you're actually systematically relaxing each muscle. Here in a body scan, you're just actually scanning your body and trying to understand and be aware to whatever that part of your body is telling you. But not interpreting it, not having negative sort of thoughts about it, just almost like you're on the balcony looking at yourself and trying to say, what exactly is this experience? Breathing is, again, useful in mindfulness because what it does is it actually serves as a grounding while you're becoming aware of your pain experience, and also reduces, generally speaking, the stress that's associated with sort of this negative amplification of pain that many of us experience. Distractions do have a role in mindfulness and in cognitive behavioral therapy, especially if they're a systematic approach to reducing stress. So this requires a lot of self-awareness and self-knowledge to know what distractions work for you and some what don't. Right? For some people, engaging in stimulating, intellectually stimulating conversations is very distracting. For others, not so much. For some, reading a book is really, a very helpful distractor. For others, not so much. Video games, etc. There are many complementary and alternative approaches towards pain management. The unfortunate thing is we do not have good data on any of these strategies. Most of these, both herbs and even acupuncture, we only have inconclusive data about their effectiveness. So we do know that acupuncture can be effective for certain kinds of headaches, and it actually can be effective for fatigue, for certain kinds of fatigue in cancer. But if you look at the entire literature of acupuncture, we do not find consistently that it has a consistent benefit around pain. That being said, for many people, it's a very useful adjunctive approach. I often recommend acupuncture to folks as an adjunctive approach to their pain. And for a small subset, it's quite effective. So this falls under the category of what some of us in healthcare or in research call an N of one study. So you're the N of one. It's one person. You have to actually do a trial for yourself and see if it actually works. And if it does, then that's your best, assessment that it actually is an effective thing to try. For all of these different kinds of strategies in palliative care, we always take a team-based approach towards addressing pain. Because pain, as we talked about at the very beginning, is a very complex phenomenon. It requires a real shared and holistic approach towards addressing pain to address it effectively and in a supportive way. And so for most palliative care programs, we think about all these things at the same time when we're actually thinking about how to come up with a tailored plan of care for pain. I want to sort of close out by just telling you a story about effective pain management. So this woman was sort of the model of exuberance. She lived with actual many, many chronic medical conditions for her and most of her life, but it never stopped her. When she was in her 80s, she developed liver cancer because she had developed hepatitis C from blood transfusions that she had received earlier in her life. With liver cancer, she developed some significant pain that actually caused tremendous amount of debilitation. She went to palliative care. She actually was placed on a holistic approach towards pain, including the use of opioids. And with that, she just sort of like rose up from her back to her usual exuberant self. She did something called play the bones. How many of you in this room have heard of the bones? Oh, a couple. So the bones, according to this person, is one of the most ancient percussion instruments that exists. Bones were first created out of cow ribs and then eventually were made out of wood. And they're basically a percussion instrument that you put between your fingers and are often used in folk music. It turns out that there is a group of bones players around the country and the world. And this person actually found out that there was a person in California that told her about this Bones Fest in Louisville, Kentucky. She went to the Bones Fest, only could have gotten there because of this holistic approach to pain that she had received, had the time of her life. Let's see if you can find her here. There she is. And came home 2 weeks later, died from her liver cancer. She would not have been able to go to that Bones Fest had she had her pain not been in control, had she not had a holistic approach towards her pain. I know a lot about her because she's my mother. And that's what we want for everybody. We want everybody to have a holistic approach to their pain taken seriously, especially if they have, are experiencing serious illness. And to do this effectively, it does require a team. So to sum up, pain is very common in the setting of serious illness. It's a very complex experience, and I hope that's one of your big take-home messages from today. It's not just biological. It's biological, it's emotional, it's social, and that's why it's so important and why it's also so difficult to manage well. There are many effective medicines for pain, but unfortunately, most of our effective medicines for pain have many problematic side effects. So it's important to be aware of those side effects, to weigh them in a dynamic way as one goes through one's illness, and then using a holistic approach that includes physical therapy, that includes mindfulness, that includes cognitive behavioral therapy, that includes a supportive environment. One can often very effectively manage pain and enable people to do things like my mother did, which was play the bones in one big last hurrah. So with that, I will stop, and I'm very happy to answer questions. Okay, so there are two questions. The first question is, what about aspirin? And the second question is, what about if someone's very sleepy on one of these medicines? So aspirin is actually a very effective pain medicine. The problem is it has a very small, what we call ceiling effect in terms of toxicity. It can be a very toxic medicine if taken excessively. And aspirin toxicity is rapidly fatal. So if taken sort of in the small amounts that we use for people who are using it for heart disease, it's fine. You can actually take it in scheduled doses, but it tends to actually have this sort of ceiling effect that doesn't actually ultimately often have enough pain relief, but then is associated with significant toxicity. With respect to the sleepiness, a lot of times people who've been in a lot of pain, when they're placed on a pain medicine and they finally experience relief, they just sleep. So we see this a lot. We'll see people who, you know, they've been so exhausted by their pain, they haven't been able to sleep for days. And when they get placed on a pain medicine that actually is effective, they'll sleep. Now, that's usually for several days. It's not for weeks. It's not for 7 days. So if someone is just sleeping for a few days and then they sort of come back and are themselves, then I think then we can say they needed that sleep. And we should actually encourage them, to experience that. On the other hand, if people continue to be sleepy, then one of those two strategies that we talked about, I think, needs to be considered, which is either looking at a change in the medication or an addition of a medicine that actually serves as a stimulant that helps to wake them up. Ideally, you don't want to act to add more and more medicines to treat the side effects of the medicines. Sometimes one has to do that.
And does the behavioral therapy affect the sleeping?
The behavioral therapy has a positive impact on sleep. But whether or not it influences the sleep because of pain, I think we don't really know. Yes? Great question. So what about medical cannabis? Now that medical cannabis is more and more available, we're getting more and more literature about medical cannabis. And what we're seeing with cannabis is that in a subset of people, it actually is effective in terms of improving their overall pain. For many people, there's not much of an effect, and there are high levels of side effects that can be very distressing, especially around hallucinations or very vivid and distressing dreams. So this falls under the category a lot of times where someone may trial it to see if actually they fall into that category, but it's not a large population, and the literature does not consistently demonstrate effectiveness for pain. Yeah, I know Abrams has done studies in the past. There are more challenges with doing studies in public institutions because of our need to be in compliance with federal regulations in addition to state regulations. So private institutions, ironically, have fewer hoops to actually go through these trials. But there are a number of studies actually occurring now around the country to evaluate medical cannabis, which is really important, and I'm really delighted that finally we'll be able to evaluate it in a systematic way. Yes, yeah, so COX-2 inhibitors are a medicine that we thought would be the answer to all of our problems around GI bleeding because they're sort of a variant of a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent. And it turns out that they still are associated with GI bleeding, not to quite the same degree as non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, and they are associated with increased risk for stroke and cardiovascular events like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents. For that reason, Vioxx, many of you may remember this, was taken off the market. Celebrex is still available on the market, and the same sort of precautions that we think about with respect to non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents are appropriate for Celebrex or Celecoxib, which is the generic name. The question is around the sort of general hesitancy to have loved ones go on these pain medications for fear that it will cause excessive sedation or confusion. And I think those are, those are born out of several things. First of all, there are certain medications that are more commonly associated with that kind of confusion. And so if you've experienced that, you don't forget it. The second is that I do feel like a lot of times we as healthcare providers don't provide enough guidance or sort of understanding of the fact that many of these situations do go away to folks, and so they just stop prematurely. So it is partly our fault that we don't actually communicate effectively to folks when they're starting on these medicines, but it is also the case that there are some people who actually have to make that choice, getting back to the question around advanced directives, of do I feel better and, am I able to do more and function more, even though I don't feel quite as sharp or is being sharp so important to me that I'm willing to not necessarily feel quite as good. So there are people who actually feel quite strongly about, being sharp, but I think oftentimes what happens is decisions are made without a lot of creative work around adjuvant therapy or changing medications prematurely about just throwing the baby out with the bathwater when that doesn't need to happen. Well, thank you for your attention. It was really great spending this time with you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.